The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And as we look at the Week magazine for this holiday week between Christmas and New Year's, we're reading from the edition dated December 28th, 2012 to January 4th of 2013. So we'll be reading some special items here that we don't normally have time to get around to because we'll be using this magazine for 2 weeks. We'll begin, as usual, with the main story section of the Week magazine. The headline is The Newtown School Massacre. Here's what happened. America's long, bitter debate over gun control seemed to reach a turning point this past week after a lone gunman armed with a semi-automatic assault rifle horrified the nation when he slaughtered 20 first graders in an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut. Adam Lanza, 20, broke into Sandy Hook Elementary School last week armed with two handguns, a Bushmaster AR-15 semi-automatic rifle, and several hundred rounds of ammunition, all legally purchased by his mother, Nancy. Firing hundreds of rounds from the Bushmaster, he worked his way through two first-grade classrooms, killing 14 children in one and six in the other, firing at least three bullets and up to 11 into each victim. The principal, the school psychologist, and four teachers also lost their lives trying to prevent the massacre. Lanza used one of the handguns to shoot himself dead as police arrived on the scene. Police later discovered his mother shot to death in her home. The brutal effectiveness of Lanza's killing spree shocked the nation and sparked widespread calls for tougher gun control laws. "These tragedies must end," said President Obama at an interfaith service for the Newtown victims and their families. "And to end them, we must change." The White House announced the formation of a special task force headed by Vice President Joe Biden to formulate the specific policies that might prevent future mass shootings. Obama said he wanted legislation submitted to Congress within a month, saying it should include a renewal of the federal ban on assault rifles like the AR-15, which expired in 2004. A ban on large-capacity ammunition clips that allow 30 to 100 rapid-fire shots without reloading, and closure of a loophole allowing unlicensed buyers to purchase weapons at gun shows. Some Republicans said they'd resist such legislation, but several Democrats with a record of strong support of gun rights, including West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, said the Connecticut massacre had changed America. He pledged support for common sense legislation to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines and to do whatever I can do to protect children. Here's what the editorial said. "Let's start with a ban on assault weapons that were designed for one thing, mass slaughter," said the Washington Post. The Bushmaster Lanza used is a version of the M16 used by the military and does not belong in private hands any more than an M1 Abrams tank, hand grenades, or mortars do. Fully automatic weapons or machine guns are already banned with no negative impact on the Second Amendment, said the New York Post. Modern semi-automatic weapons can fire dozens of rounds in seconds, making them just as deadly as the fully automatic gangster guns banned by Congress in 1934. They are not necessary for self-defense or for hunting, and it's time to get rid of them. "It's only natural to seek a protective salve of public policy in the wake of such a massacre," said the Wall Street Journal. "But let's not rush into a new round of gun restrictions, which alone do little to prevent widespread acts of terror." Norway's tight gun control and licensing regime did not deter Anders Breivik from shooting 69 people dead last year. Not everyone believes the Second Amendment gives Americans an absolute right to own guns, said the New York Times, but the Supreme Court has ruled that it does, and some 68% of the public agrees. So whatever reforms we make must respect the concerns of law-abiding, safety-conscious gun owners. At the same time, gun enthusiasts must recognize that none of the Constitution's protections are so absolute that they erase concerns about public safety and welfare. Now here's what the columnist said. Why can't we regulate guns as seriously as we do cars, said Nicholas Kristof, also in the New York Times. Guns kill one person every 20 minutes in this country, and yet they are almost free of federal restrictions. To drive a car, however, one must pass written and driving tests, wear seat belts, and follow safety laws. Can't we be equally adult about regulating guns? Gun control laws can work, said Will Oremus in Slate.com. In Australia, a shooting massacre in 1996 prompted the government to ban the sale of semi-automatic guns, buy back those in circulation, and require gun purchasers to register all weapons under their own names. Gun deaths there dropped 59% over the following decade, with not a single mass shooting since. This isn't Australia, said Nick Gillespie in Reason.com. This is America, where our Supreme Court has upheld an individual right to bear arms. Sandy Hook was a terrible crime, but let's remember how the country overreacted to 9/11 with the Patriot Act and other violations of civil liberties. Few good policies come from rapid responses to deeply felt injuries. The most effective response would be to let citizens carry weapons in all public places, said John Fund in the NationalReview.com. Mass killers always pick gun-free zones where people are helpless. These cowards would be deterred if they knew someone would shoot back. We'll all hear more of such nonsense in coming weeks and months, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Reformers may think the utter emotional devastation inflicted by Sandy Hook will finally shame the National Rifle Association and its congressional supporters, but ultra-conservatives in the House fear only being primaried into their ultra-conservative districts. Some events, though, carry such emotional power that they can change history, said Peggy Noonan in WSJ.com. If Democrats act quickly and narrowly, they can reimpose a ban on assault weapons and extended ammunition clips. Obama also has an opening to address the culture of death in Hollywood movies, TV shows, and video games. A sickened American public is eager for real leadership. Newtown changes everything. The next item is entitled The Heroes of Sandy Hook. When Adam Lanza broke into Sandy Hook Elementary School, armed with a semi-automatic assault rifle and two handguns, Principal Dawn Hochsprung, 47, did not cower. The dedicated educator charged out of the school office, confronted Lanza in the hallway, and was gunned down as she lunged at him. "I'm not surprised she gave her life in this fashion, trying to protect her students," said a friend, Gerald Stomsky. As Lanza advanced toward classrooms, he was also confronted by Vice Principal Natalie Hammond and school psychologist Mary Sherlock, who planned to retire at the end of the year. Hammond was wounded in the leg. Sherlock was killed. "Someone had flicked on the loudspeaker," said the Los Angeles Times, "and the sounds staffers heard clearly were not part of a drill." Teachers scrambled to save the children. Music teacher Mary Rose Christopic quickly put 20 kids in a large closet and blocked her classroom's door with a xylophone. Caitlin Roig ushered her first graders into the class bathroom and implored them to be quiet. As she heard the gunman outside, she made a point of saying that she loved them. "I wanted that to be one of the last things they heard," she told ABC News, "not the gunfire in the hallway. He passed them by." Rachel DeVino, a behavioral therapist whose boyfriend planned to propose to her on Christmas Eve, was killed, shielding children from Adam Lanza's bullets, police told her family. So was teacher Lauren Gabrielle Rousseau. When teacher Victoria Soto heard the shooting, She ordered her kids into a closet and bravely placed herself between the young children and Lanza, said the DailyBeast.com. She did what she was trained to do, said her cousin, but also what her heart told her to do. Police said Soto and Anne Marie Murphy, an aide for a special needs child, were both found in the classroom, covering the bodies of the children they had loved and died trying to protect. The third item also related, the killer. I'm losing him. Soon after he began his freshman year at Newtown High School, staff members began to worry about Adam Lanza. He was assigned a psychologist, and teachers agreed to keep a close eye on the withdrawn, friendless teen. But not because they thought Lanza was dangerous. It was completely the opposite, said Richard Novia, a former advisor at the school's tech club. We were worried about him being the victim. Lanza stood out from an early age, said DailyMail.co.uk. At Sandy Hook Elementary School, said a former classmate, Lanza stood alone at recess, looking angry and making animal-like noises. In high school, he was known as a tech geek, who carried pens in his shirt pocket and a black briefcase. Although highly intelligent, he would shrink from teachers' questions and walk down corridors pressing against the wall, almost like he was afraid of people, said Andrew Lapple, who sat next to Lanza in homeroom. Family, friends, and former school officials said Lanza had Asperger's syndrome, a high-functioning form of autism, but also a more serious psychological disorder. Outside of school, Lanza's adolescence seemed to have been turbulent, said the New York Times. He was deeply upset when his parents divorced when he was 17. Not long afterward, Lanza stopped talking to his father, Peter, and older brother, Ryan. He lived with his mother, Nancy, in their $1.6 million Newtown home, and family friends said he spent much of his time in the windowless basement playing violent video games. Friends remembered Nancy, 52, as a doting mother who devoted herself to Lanza's care and hoped he could live a normal life, said the Wall Street Journal. She was considering moving to Washington State so that Lanza could enroll in a special college there. Nancy, who owned all of the weapons used in the school massacre, often took Lanza to local shooting ranges. Guns require a lot of respect, and she really tried to instill that responsibility within him, said Russell Hanneman, a family friend. But less than a week before her son would kill her, Nancy confessed to a drinking buddy that Adam was becoming increasingly distant and morose. She just looked down at the glass and said, "I don't know him. I'm worried. I'm losing him," the friend said. The next item from the main story section also related is the controversy of the week, and it's entitled Newtown, Violence, Video Games, and Mental Illness. It's time to talk about guns, said Nicholas Thompson in NewYorker.com, but it's also time to talk about a lot more. After last week's unimaginable massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, where 20-year-old Adam Lanza shot dead 20 children, Americans must recognize that such violence isn't the product of weak gun laws. It's much deeper than that. It's time to look hard at America's culture of violence, including movies, music, and video games. The super realistic shootings and explosions and fetishistic acts of vengeance that fill popular culture, feed the fantasies of troubled loners, and even make blowing people away look like fun. Some of these video games look just like police and military simulators I've used, said former Army Ranger and former police trainer Dave Grossman in Patch.com. Kids who amass points by mowing down waves of attackers learn the same kinds of conditioned responses, killing skills, and desensitization we teach to soldiers. If kids playing these games are emotionally disturbed, they can readily take these lessons into the real world, making battlefields of schools and malls. Video games may feed violent fantasy, said David Koppel in the Wall Street Journal, but so do the news media. Part of what drives many of these atrocities is the instant celebrity that a mass killer can achieve. The media frenzy that follows every one of these attacks is not lost on troubled loners who crave recognition by their suffering and a powerful expression of their rage. By going on a killing spree, they know they will become famous anti-heroes with their names and faces immortalized on every TV news program, newspaper, and website. If we want the massacres to stop, said Tim Berry in BusinessInsider.com, then all media outlets should simply agree to not publish killers' names or pictures, the way they don't publish those of rape victims. There's a more complex problem at the root of this, said Lisa Long in HuffingtonPost.com, and it's mental illness. I'm the mother of a brilliant 13-year-old boy who, much like Adam Lanza, cannot relate to people and suffers inexplicable attacks of sudden violent rage. He's seen counselors and psychiatrists and takes a slew of antipsychotic and mood-altering pharmaceuticals, all to no avail. This problem is too big for me to handle on my own. Yet the only options open to parents like me are to ask authorities to put our kids in jail or lock them up in a mental institution. We don't know yet if Adam Lanza was mentally ill or whether a better system would have helped him, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. But Jared Loughner, who went on a shooting spree in Tucson, and James Holmes, who perpetrated the massacre in Aurora, Colorado, clearly were schizophrenic. We need more psychiatric beds and a better legal mechanism to compel people with serious mental illnesses to get treatment. No single solution will suffice, said Andrew O'Hare in Salon.com. Horrors like Sandy Hook are the product of a toxic stew of legal, cultural, and psychological forces. And if we're to prevent future shootings, we need to address all of them. Ultimate safety is beyond our reach, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post, but this does not mean we are helpless. The process of preventing another Sandy Hook begins with us finding our resolve. Whatever practical measures we take in the coming months, the first necessary response to the unacceptable is not to accept it. And now, after rather disturbing news opening there, it's a tough story for all of us to listen to. Let's move on now to something a little bit lighter. How about the feature article, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4? It was a good week for President Barack Obama, who was officially reelected for his second term by the Electoral College, with 332 electoral votes to Mitt Romney's 206. Three Republican electors from Arizona, however, registered objections, insisting that Obama had never submitted a legitimate birth certificate. It was a good week for buying a carry-on suitcase after new federal data showed that the major U.S. airlines collected $924 million in revenue from bag check fees over just 3 months. A major source of their profits. And it was a good week for a visit from E.T. after astronomers discovered several planets orbiting a sun-like star called Tau Ceti, just 12 light-years away, including one that might have Earth-like temperatures and water. It was a bad week for conservative spending. After Mitt Romney's presidential campaign was challenged by 9 media organizations over exorbitant charges to reporters covering the campaign charged reporters up to $812 for a single meal and a place to file their stories and $1,000 for a seat on the bus. It was a bad week for the steal of the week after a California condo failed to attract any buyers despite being listed for $1. The condo, located in a luxury retirement complex, carries $1,718 in monthly charges and is a good deal, but not a good investment, a realtor says. And it was a bad week for Charlie, a mixed-breed dog in Southampton, England, with a penchant for eating things after surgeons had to remove a foot-long string of Christmas lights from his stomach. I have never known a dog to act like this before, sighed the owner. Now, Now, from the Week magazine for this week, we'll take a look at the briefing section, and this week it is entitled, The First Noel. History suggests that Jesus wasn't born in a stable or visited by three wise men. What's the real Christmas story? First, what's the origin of the Nativity story? Some of it is in the Bible. The Gospel of Matthew mentions the wise men and the star of Bethlehem, while the Gospel of Luke describes awestruck shepherds and says that Jesus was born in a stable because all of the inns were full. Over the centuries, the customary nativity scene was embellished with other lore, giving us the image of the baby Jesus lying in a manger and surrounded by his parents, Mary and Joseph, as shepherds, oxen, asses, and three wise men look on. But we have it on no less an authority than Pope Benedict XVI that the traditional creche tableau has little basis in fact. There were, for example, likely no animals present. The Pope writes in his new book, Jesus of Nazareth, The Infancy Narratives, the tradition of the ox and ass stems from early Christian teachings that even animals recognized Jesus as the Son of God. Benedict is not alone in casting doubt on the popular version of Christ's birth. It's virtually impossible to reduce the accounts to a single core narrative, said religious historian L. Michael White. When was Christ born? Almost certainly not 2012 years ago or on December 25th. Matthew places Jesus' birth in the final years of the rule of Judea's Rome-backed king Herod the Great, who died in 4 BC. Pope Benedict writes that Christ was probably born less than 2 years before that, putting his birth in 5 or 6 BC. The Roman Catholic Church chose December 25th as Christ's birthday in the 4th century in order to co-opt a pagan feast day. To define Christ's actual date of birth, scholars looked to when the Star of Bethlehem might have appeared. What was the Star of Bethlehem? Well, there are various theories. According to Matthew, the wise men saw a bright light in the heavens and followed it to Jesus' birthplace. Some say it was a nova, or the explosion of a white dwarf star, recorded by Chinese sky watchers in 5 BC, while others suggest it was the planet Jupiter, which would have appeared to be drifting westward in the sky from September of 3 BC until the following May. Astronomer John Moseley of the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles recently theorized that the Star of Bethlehem was actually a convergence of Jupiter and Venus that took place on June 17th in 2 BC. The two planets had merged into one single gleaming object in the direction of Jerusalem as seen in Persia, he said. So the wise men were Persian? The Gospel of Matthew says only that they came from the east and refers to them as magi. That term can apply to the priestly caste of Zoroastrianism, a monotheistic Persian religion whose adherents seek guidance in stars. The idea that there were three of them and that they were kings originated in much later texts, identifying them as Balthazar, Melchior, and Caspar, kings of Arabia, Persia, and India, respectively. Biblical scholars say this element was incorporated into the Nativity tale to reflect the Christian tradition that all peoples recognized Christ's divinity. University of Oklahoma theology professor Brent Landau has identified an 8th century text that purports to be the Magi's own account of Christ's birth. In it, a dozen religious mystics travel, probably from China to Bethlehem, to witness the event. There are no other early Christian writings that provide such complete explanation of these mysterious figures, said Landau. Where was Jesus born? Most scholars agree that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, but not in a stable. The Gospel of Luke says that Mary laid Jesus in a manger because there was no room in the inn. But the word inn in the King James Bible is commonly agreed to be a mistranslation of a Greek term for a spare room. And in those days, most families kept their animals inside the house, not in a separate outhouse. So Jesus was most likely born, according to historian R.T. France, in the main living room of a peasant house where animals are brought in at night. Should these discrepancies bother Christians? The Pope says no. The aim of the evangelist was not to produce an exhaustive account, he writes, but a record of what seemed important for the nascent faith community in light of the world. And the Word. The Nativity story emphasizes Christ's humility and the wonder of God taking on human form. The accounts of Jesus' life are not intended as history, said Bart Ehrman, a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, but as gospels, proclamations of the good news. The true meaning of Christ, he says, lies not in what really did happen, but in what really does happen in the lives of those who believe that stories such as these can convey a greater truth. What did Jesus look like? The Gospels say nothing about Jesus' ethnicity other than that he was Jewish, but scholars have painted him in many colors. As early as 1836, the English historian Godfrey Higgins suggested that Jesus was a dark-skinned Indian. Some African-American Christians, including Jesse Jackson, have claimed he was black, arguing that Mary descended from a tribe of African Jews. The earliest surviving images of Jewish people date to the 3rd century, so we have little historical record to go on, though it's unlikely Jesus was the blue-eyed, fair-haired man of Western tradition. An anthropological study in 2001 concluded that it was most likely Jesus had olive skin, short, dark, curly hair, and a swarthy appearance. The West's inaccurate impression, said theologian Charles Hackett, is a reminder of our tendency to sinfully appropriate him in the service of our cultural values. Now we'll turn to the best columns of the week in the United States. According to The Week magazine, our first one is entitled The NRA's Profit Motive, written by Jordan Weissman in TheAtlantic.com. Whom does the NRA really speak for? Asked Jordan Weissman, yes, the National Rifle Association represents 4 million gun owners, the deer hunters, and self-defense-minded Second Amendment devotees who would kindly like the government to keep its hands off their Glocks and AR-15s. But in a very direct way, the NRA also represents Bushmaster, Browning, Smith & Wesson, and the rest of the gun industry. Gun makers have donated at least $39 million to the NRA in recent years and have become deeply enmeshed with the organization's revenues through special gun purchase deals and ads in its publications. As a result, the NRA adamantly opposes virtually all restrictions on gun sales, even ones that NRA members support, such as requiring background checks at gun shows and banning sales to people on the terrorist watch list. Gun makers can no longer depend on a shrinking pool of hunters. They need to sell arsenals of powerful weaponry to hardcore gun devotees preparing to fight a tyrannical government. So when the NRA speaks, it's these extremists and their suppliers who are talking, not your average Joe six-shooter. The next column is entitled The Plight of the Black Male by Michael Gerson in The Washington Post. In his second term, President Obama cannot continue to ignore the single greatest threat to the unity of America, said Michael Gerson. It's the vast, increasing segregation of young African-American men and boys from the promise of their country. More than 50% of urban black teenagers drop out of high school, and unemployment rates among young black males are staggering. 1 in 3 wind up in jail at some point in their life. This dysfunction is being perpetuated in another generation, with just 37% of black children raised in two-parent families. Social scientists list many causes: persistent racism, lousy schools, the growth of an oppositional culture that undermines achievement. Yet there's absolutely no national urgency about this ongoing American tragedy. That's an indictment of everyone, including liberals, who once cared about something more than the marginal tax rates and the interests of the middle class. Obama is uniquely qualified to lead on this issue, and it should be at the top of his second-term agenda. And our third column this week in the Week magazine is New Year's Resolutions Don't Work by Oliver Berkman in Newsweek. Millions of Americans will attempt to turn over a new leaf on January 1st, pledging to lose weight, spend less money, and quit smoking, said Oliver Berkman. But despite what the self-help industry might tell you, radical across-the-board changes like New Year's resolutions rarely work in practice. Willpower, studies have shown, is a depletable resource. If you make an overnight change requiring enormous self-discipline, you can quickly use up your stores of willpower, and all your best intentions will fall by the wayside. But tiny goals, even absurdly tiny ones, can be an effective way to sneak up upon the radar of your mind. Exercising for 5 minutes instead of an hour might sound laughable, but you're much less likely to resist it, and the next day you can exercise for six. Want a better job? Commit to just 2 hours a week of networking and investigating opportunities. New Year's resolutions are based on the fallacy that if only you can find sufficient motivation, you can achieve anything. In reality, motivation is fleeting, and the biggest barrier to actually getting things done? Want real change? Take small steps. Now let's take a look at a couple of extra columns this week. These are called the best columns in Europe for this past week, according to the Week magazine. The first one takes place in the United Kingdom. The title of it is Still Under the Thumb of Normans, and it was written by Paul Kingsnorth in The Guardian. Can't pay your mortgage? Blame the Normans, said Paul Kingsnorth. The outrageous prices for land and housing in this country, and we're referring to the United Kingdom, are a direct result of the policies of William the Conqueror, who took over in 1066 after the Battle of Hastings. William declared himself owner of nearly every acre in England, destroying the Anglo-Saxon heritage of land ownership. And he then proceeded to parcel much of that land out to favored lords. The descendants of those dukes and earls still possess almost everything. Just 0.3% of the population, about 160,000 families, owns two-thirds of the land. Running Britain a close second to Brazil for the title of the country with the most unequal land distribution on earth. Sure, most of them no longer live in castles, and now we all speak the same language, but the differences are still obvious. It's worth noting that in 2012, as in 1066, the ruling classes still drink wine while the plebs drink beer. They stroll into the elite colleges of Oxford and Cambridge and then go on to plummy bank jobs while the rest of us struggle to pay bills. Nearly 1,000 years after the Norman conquest, the nation is still paying the price for the rapacity of a wealthy elite which feels no obligation to its people. The next column from Europe is Dateline, the European Union, and the title of it is The War on Christmas Has Begun by Andreas Ilkaznis, and that is in Litvos Riatas in Lithuania. A war on Christmas is being waged in Europe's capital, said Andreas Ilkaznis. We're still safe here in Lithuania, but we have reasons for wariness. The Soviets suppressed our traditional Catholicism until we broke free 2 decades ago, allowing us to celebrate with a Christmas tree in Cathedral Square in Vilnius, a nativity scene at most town halls, and the Christmas mass broadcast on public television. Now we worry that all this is temporary, like an All Souls candle in the wind. In Brussels, authorities have, for the first time, failed to put up the traditional 7-story fir, erecting instead a vile modern art display. It's unclear whether Belgian or EU officials are responsible, but it doesn't really matter. Brussels is the capital of Europe, and it has chosen to squelch the Christmas spirit out of politeness, indolence, and a desire to avoid conflict with the burgeoning Muslim population. Already a quarter of the city's inhabitants are Muslims, and Mohammed is now the most popular name for baby boys. Rather than insist on its centuries-old traditions, weary and lethargic Christian Europe has surrendered at its heart. Is Vilnius just a few hours away? Journey from Brussels next? I fear I can already feel the icy breath of the new era. And again, that article was written in Vilnius, Lithuania. And now we'll turn to the back of the magazine for this combined edition of the Week magazine, December 28th and January 4th, to the last word. It is entitled this week, Confessions of a Hotel Insider. If you want the best room, sparkling service, and free booze, says Jacob Tomsky, just follow these rules. I've worked in hotels for more than a decade. I've checked you in, checked you out, oriented you to the property, served you a beverage, separated your white panties from the white bed sheets, parked your car, tasted your room service before and sadly after, cleaned your toilet, denied you a late checkout, given you a wake-up call, eaten M&Ms out of your minibar, laughed at your jokes, and taken your money. From New Orleans to New York, I've played by hotel rules and in the process learned every aspect of the industry. Due to the fact that I just don't care anymore, I will now offer easy and never publicized tips and tricks. Want a late checkout? An upgrade? Guess what? There are simple ways, and most of them are legal, to get what you need from a hotel without any hassle whatsoever. But first, let me warn you about a few things that drive hotel staffers crazy. Things a guest should never say. My credit card declined? That's impossible. Run it again. Man, don't make me run it again. If your credit card declines once, it will without question decline again. Your card is not a crumpled old dollar, and the banking system is not a stubborn vending machine. That's not how the banking system works. You need to call your bank, and no, you can't use my phone. They told me I should ask for an upgrade. Who the heck is they? Oh, they. Well, they told me to remind you to tip the doorman. Don't you remember me? Let me think about this. Average of 500 guest interactions a day. It's been 2 years since you stayed with us, so that's a clean 250,000 separate interactions since your last stay. Wait. No, I don't remember you. Now here are things a guest should never do. Do not continue your phone conversation during the entire check-in. Can you imagine how it feels as a human to be part of someone else's effort to multitask? While you say to the phone, well, I told her that wouldn't go for it. I know these people. I get the lift of an eyebrow, side glances, brief and uninterested head nods thrown in my direction indicating your main focus remains on your call, perhaps a moment where you hold the phone slightly away from your ear to benevolently allow me 5% of your attention. That call will end in 5 minutes, but because you treated me like an automatic check-in machine, this room I'm giving you will plague your whole stay. Now, here's the next one. Do not snap the credit card down on my desk. You know this one, where you press the card down with your thumb and use your index finger to bend the front corner of the card up and then release it so it snaps authoritatively and loudly on my desk. You just made me hate you. The next bit of advice here, do not hold out your hand for the change you're waiting on. You know when I am still counting it out, but your hand is there in front of me, floating in the air, waiting while I count, empty, implying impatience, and uselessly reasserting the fact that the money I am counting belongs to you. Relax, buddy. It's coming. You look like a 5-year-old with your hand out like that. Okay, the next advice. Do not threaten a front desk agent, ever. I have taken rooms from people who were even pre-registered into a gorgeous room just because their attitude was off. They never even knew they were originally set to see Central Park in one of the corner rooms with the big bathroom. I took it from them just because they yelled at their wives or manhandled their wives' elbows in a way I didn't appreciate. At the front desk, I am a god of instant karma, and one of my other weapons is the key bomb. When I check you in, I program a single initial key, then start over and cut a second initial key. Either one of them will work when you get to the room. Slide one in, you get the green light, and as long as you keep using the very first key you slipped in, all will be well. But chances are you'll pop in the second key at some point, and then the first key you used will be considered, as far as the dumbass lock is concerned, invalid. At some point after that, you will be locked outside your room, jamming your first key into the slot, fighting that damn red light. I also happen to know the electronic curtains are not functioning in room 3217, and it gets loads of morning sun in there. Good luck sleeping in. If I put you in room 1212 in New York City, your phone will stop ringing with wrong numbers. Well, why? A surprising number of guests never seem to learn that you have to dial 9 to make an outside call. So all day, and believe me, all night, idiots dispersed throughout the building will pick up their phones and try to straight dial a local number, starting with 1212. Whatever they press after that matters not, because they have already dialed room 1212, and 1212's guest will constantly pick up the 3 a.m. call and hear the loud mashing of other numbers, or some drunk guest saying, "Hello, hello, who is this?" Now, here are things that every guest must know. You never have to pay for using the minibar. Minibar charges are, without question, the most disputed charges on any bill. Why? Because it's done by people. The traditional minibar, before they invented the censored variety, is checked maybe once a day by a slow-moving gentleman or a lady pushing a cart full of snacks. Keystroke errors, delays in restocking, double stocking, and hundreds of other missteps make minibar charges the most voided item. Even before guests can manage to get through half of the "I never had these items" sentence, I have already removed the charges. You don't have to pay for the in-room movies either. Here's how, in 3 easy steps. Watch and enjoy the movie. Call down and say you accidentally clicked on it. Or it cut off in the middle. Or it froze near the end. Or it never even started. Would you like them to restart the movie for you? No thanks. You need to go to bed? Leave now. Just remove the charge, please. 3. Order another movie. And you can easily avoid a same-day cancellation penalty. This little move will not work with online prepaid reservations, only what we call natural reservations booked through any channel as long as it's not prepaid. Call the property directly and ask for the front desk. "Good evening. Thank you for calling the front desk. My name is..." "Doesn't matter. How can I assist you?" "Excuse me, are you the manager?" If the person says yes, hang up and call back. "What we want here is certainly not the manager." "No, I am not. Would you like to speak to the manager?" "No, actually, I just have a quick request. I think you can help me. Well, I was supposed to fly in late tonight, but my 12-year-old daughter is sick." "Let me stop you right there, dear guest. Sure, you need a reason, but what you don't need is a 45-minute story. Try again." No, actually, I just have a quick request. I think you can help me. I've had a personal emergency and won't be able to check in tonight. However, I have already rescheduled my meeting for next week. Do you think you could just shift tonight's reservation to next Friday without a penalty? Sure, next Friday, the 24th, all set. Same confirmation number. See you then. Thank you. Done. Now you have a reservation all set for next Friday. Why is that good? Well, tomorrow, whenever you get around to it, call the hotel back, this time no need to inquire about a manager, and just tell the front desk you want to cancel your reservations for next Friday, as you are well within your rights to do. No problem. More good advice here from the last word this week. If you are going to complain, if you must complain, then please eat a mint. Self-explanatory. You catch more bees with honey than with garbage. Well, bees love garbage. Damn, whatever. Just eat a mint. The next item. I don't want to hear your tragic airline delay story. I don't at all. The next item. You should never feel comfortable enough to actually call us by the names on our name tags. Gluing a name tag to anyone's chest makes him or her subordinate. Using it without permission implies that you are aware of this fact, and you don't mind rudely pointing it out. To pick the name off a tag and use it, whatever your intention, makes employees acutely feel they have lost their personal worth, that they themselves are included in the price. Their mothers use that name on a birthday to ask personal name, did you get everything you wanted, baby? What right do you have to use it? Just because you walked into the lobby? My advice is to ask for permission. Jake, may I call you Jake? Yes, you may, and thank you. Now, finding your agent. What are we looking for in our agent? Someone who is efficient and not at all nervous, almost bored. If the agent is overly zealous or nervous, he or she might have just begun working at the property. Not only does the agent have to be comfortable playing the game, the agent must know the property and the system well enough to play it properly. Tip up front. Let the agent know you are serious immediately. Here's how I do it. I walk up, smile without showing teeth, give the agent my credit card, drop a 20 on the desk, and say, "This is for you. Whatever you can do for me, I'd appreciate it." Boom. If I am after something specific, I will include that as well. "This is for you. Whatever you can do for me, I'd appreciate a room upgrade, late checkout, wine, whatever." Finally, if you happen to have a successful experience, then make a point to memorize the agent's name. Now, here is a list of 10 standard front desk lies. All the rooms are basically the same size. The second one, "Of course I remember you. Welcome back." The third, "There is nothing I can do." The fourth, "I appreciate your feedback." The fifth, "I'm sorry the bellman made you uncomfortable. I will certainly alert management." The sixth lie, "I didn't mean to sound insulting." The seventh, "I will mail this immediately." The eighth, "My pleasure." The ninth, "I would like to offer my deepest apologies." And the tenth standard lie at the front desk, "We hope to see you again." And these were all from the book Heads in Bed by Jacob Tomsky, published by arrangement with Doubleday, an imprint of the Knopf Doubleday Publishing Group. Now we'll turn to the Talking Point section in the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled, "Torture. Did it lead to Bin Laden?" Did torture lead to the killing of Osama bin Laden, asks Massimo Calabrese in Time.com? The answer is now officially no. After a three-year investigation, the Senate Intelligence Committee last week approved a 6,000-page report on the CIA's detention and interrogation program that confirms that the Bush-Cheney administration's post-9/11 embrace of torture did not yield any critical intelligence. The classified report has not been made public, but committee chair Senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat from California, said it concluded that the breakthrough in the hunt for the al-Qaeda leader, learning the name of his personal courier, was achieved through conventional interrogation and painstaking intelligence, not by the use of waterboarding and other torture methods. Shamefully, said Glenn Greenwald in Guardian.co.uk, the report is going to get vastly less attention than Zero Dark Thirty, director of Catherine Bigelow's dramatized version of the Abbottabad raid, which falsely depicts torture as leading to bin Laden. Actually, Bigelow has it right, said Kyle Smith in the New York Post. The film accurately depicts how a captured al-Qaeda terrorist gives up the pseudonym of bin Laden's courier, Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, after being sexually humiliated, kept awake for days, and stuffed in a coffin-sized box. It also shows how the CIA confirmed the courier's critical importance when another detainee desperately insists, even while being waterboarded, that al-Kuwaiti is of no importance. Liberals are condemning Bigelow as a torture apologist, but this is because they live in a fairy tale of their own creation in which there is always a good, just, and fair way to solve problems. In the real world, we are often forced to choose between bad choices and worse choices. The claim that torture played a key role in finding bin Laden has been debunked repeatedly by reliable sources with access to the facts, said Jane Mayer in NewYorker.com. The CIA had already learned of the existence of the courier before it began torturing detainees. More importantly, the world's civilized nations didn't ban torture because it's ineffective. They banned it because it's morally repugnant. We'll never know if we could have found bin Laden without resorting to torture, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post, but we do know that until 9/11 warped our perspective, America didn't use these practices. We should oppose torture because it's wrong, not because it doesn't work. The next item is entitled Obamacare, the Republican Rebellion. The conservative fight against the president's health care law isn't over, said Jason Millman in Politico.com. The Republican governors of 30 states are now presenting a unified front to sink Obamacare, confirming this week they will refuse to set up health care exchanges, the marketplaces in which 25 million uninsured Americans will shop for subsidized health insurance plans starting in October 2013. The federal government will be obliged to set up exchanges in those states itself, but it's far from clear whether it is equipped to handle millions of enrollments, questions from confused customers, and greater health plan oversight. Business is resisting Obamacare, too, said Grace Marie Turner in Forbes.com. Some companies are cutting workers to part-time work hours to avoid the law's mandate that all full-time employees be covered. 6 million Americans, meanwhile, are expected to refuse to buy insurance when the individual mandate takes effect in 2014. The Obamacare resistance movement has begun. Obamacare is here to stay, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. That makes the governor's obstruction not only unprecedented, but undemocratic. How can elected officials deliberately try to make the health care system work less effectively for their own constituents? Once Americans see how effectively the exchanges are in the 18 states that are complying, they'll demand that their obstructionist governors reconsider. The irony of irony, said E.J. Dionne, also in the Washington Post, is that by refusing to set up exchanges, these conservative governors are surrendering state control and giving liberals something far closer to the national system they hoped for. Conservatives might be more inclined to accept Obamacare if anyone understood how it worked, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But just 10 months before it truly kicks in, chaos reigns as the federal government issues 13,000 pages of new regulations, including last week a new annual fee of $63 on every private health insurance policy to help pay for individuals with pre-existing conditions. The White House, meanwhile, refuses to give states any flexibility in managing the mess it handed them. Is it any wonder so many governors, businesses, and citizens are rejecting this bewildering bureaucracy, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. Unless Obamacare's benefits outweigh the chaos it produces, it will provoke a major backlash in 2013. And now, as we reach the end of our program for this week, a few shorter items from the main story section, from the talking point section. The U.S. has the highest rate of gun ownership in the world, an average 88.8 guns per 100 people. War-torn Yemen, the second highest, has 54.8 guns for every 100 residents, while Iraq has 34.2 guns per 100 residents. There are about 14 million active hunters in America, or one out of 18 people. For the first time in human history, overeating is now more of a global health threat than hunger. More than 3 million deaths in 2010 were attributable to excess body weight, three times the death toll due to malnutrition, according to the Medical Journal. The satellite North Korea launched last week amid national triumph and international protest went out of control in orbit this week and is now tumbling and silent. And the .223 caliber Bushmaster semi-automatic assault rifle used in the Newtown School massacre is the same kind used in the Washington, D.C. area sniper shootings that left 10 dead and 3 injured. Bushmaster once promoted the rifle in a magazine ad that showed the menacing weapon under the words, "Consider your man card reissued." And now the poll watch for this week. 82% of Americans say they learned little or nothing about the Mormon faith during Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. And what do people most dread about the holidays? 58% say long lines and crowds, 41% say gaining weight, 30% say getting into debt, and 14% say holiday music. Holiday music? They don't like that? Well, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week Magazine. The program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. I hope you have a very happy holiday season and a happy new year, and join us again next week. So long until then.